It's a Monday edition of Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. Thank you for joining us. We all know Michiganians we feel are extraordinary for their memorable life experiences or their sacrifices, maybe for their success or their service, and for the insights that result from those experiences. Getting better acquainted with extraordinary people is the focus of Current State's ongoing series, Voices of Experience. This week, longtime Michigan State University economics professor Mordecai Max Krinen officially retires, ending a 57-year career on the MSU faculty. And Current State Scott Pohl is here with our latest Voices of Experience conversation. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Mark. It's believed that Max Krinen is MSU's longest-serving professor. He's timed his retirement to coincide with his 85th birthday on Tuesday. His career spans thousands of students, lectures around the world, and possibly saving MSU during tough economic times. Max Krinen grew up near Tel Aviv.
Yes, well, the state was just created. It was attacked by several neighboring countries, and we all were drafted right away. Before the state, life was not that easy. I, for example, went to high school in Tel Aviv, which involved taking a bus to the city and a bus from the city every day. The bus passed through two Arab villages, and they used to shoot at us and throw stones at us. So the bus was really reinforced steel. So there were friction. There was friction between the Jews and the Arabs, except in the winter, during the period in which citrus fruit were harvested. And both sides wanted to have it quiet, to have some prosperity, to ship the fruit to London. But then the war started, and it was a very tough war. There were 600,000 Jews in Palestine when the British left, and 6,000 were killed in the war, so it's 1% of the population, not the army. And then I left the country, but there were a succession of wars, but then came the peace. It was now, thank God, peace with Egypt and peace with Jordan. And all we have to worry about is ISIS all over the Middle East.
Did you see combat?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And it's not pleasant.
I wanted to ask you why you wanted to come to America, but I also want to ask you what interested you in economics. Perhaps they're related.
Well, they are related. I really majored in economics as an undergraduate in a school that then became part of the University of Tel Aviv, and I wanted to go to grad school. So after considering a variety of schools, and subject to approval by the Ministry of Education, and it was narrowed down to Michigan, University of Michigan, University of Pennsylvania. And I was a little, I was scared to come to a big American city and not have a room. So I insisted on a room in the dormitory. Well, Pennsylvania said, we are a city school and we don't really have dormitories. Michigan offered me a room in the dormitory, but neglected to say that it's always covered with snow. But that's what I chose, so I ended up in Michigan.
And you wound up making your career in Michigan at the other school, you might say.
Yeah, it's true. I was at the University of Michigan from 52 to 57 when I moved here to Michigan State.
Well, January 20th will be your last day.
Yes. Yes.
Officially your last day,
yeah.
And your 85th birthday.
Yeah.
You stopped teaching a couple of years ago, so
that's correct.
55 years or so of teaching, if you do the math, which
right.
I guess I've done kind of
it's true.
Correct there.
Yeah.
What did you like about teaching? It would seem that someone with a degree in economics could have made a lot of money, a lot more money maybe in the private sector. You chose teaching. Why?
Well, when I was in Ann Arbor, after my degree, or coincidental, I was working at Survey Research Center as a study director, a research outfit, and I wanted to teach 1 year to try and see what it's like. So I taught as a TA principals, and it went fantastic well. So I thought, well, maybe that's what I intended to be. That's how I ended up as a professor. I had some other offers when I graduated from the business side, but I decided, well, maybe that's what I should be doing, and that's what happened.
Never entertained thoughts of the private sector?
Yes, but I always rejected them. I felt I had a pretty satisfactory life. I had a great variety of things that I did over my career, and so there was no real reason for me to move.
There were some numbers in the profile that Matthew Miller of the Lansing State Journal wrote about you that reflect having written 15 books and 167 academic articles. That sounds like a lot. I guess maybe I'm not sure if it is in your universe. Is that a lot?
Yeah, it's pretty much. It's above average, let's put it this way.
Well, it's always good to have an above average professor on the faculty.
It's a lot, yeah.
What have you enjoyed most about teaching? And maybe what have you enjoyed the least about teaching?
Well, when I first came to Michigan State, I taught mainly principles of economics and international economics. Then there came years in which I was doing strictly with the doctoral sequence in international economics and helping students with dissertations, basically supervising dissertations, which is very time-consuming because it's one-on-one. I had about 40 dissertations over the years, and some of them I keep in touch with. Some of them I collaborated in articles and books subsequently. And then some of us took to teaching large sections of principles. I taught macro mainly, but sometimes micro, to 600 students. And that was enjoyable in a sense that you have to be a little actor and engage in give and take with some of the students, give them pennies if they ask questions, give them nickels if they challenge you. And I still taught the senior course in international economics as well. There weren't 600, it was about 300 students. It was fine. It was enjoyable. The graduate doctoral sequence was also enjoyable. I liked it a lot at the time. And I still keep in touch with some of the students. I remember that for the undergraduate classes, all the A students, I used to give about 10% A's, and all of them received what I call the love letter, a congratulatory letter. And some of them wrote to me about it. They framed it, you could use it as a recommendation. It was kind of all around pleasant. I did a lot of other things while I was doing that. I lectured around the world, God knows how many times. All European lectures, Africa, you name it. And I met a lot of people, a lot of policymakers. I remember coming to Korea, to South Korea, and all they wanted to know, how much did it cost to unify Germany? And I told them that to unify the two Koreans would cost more. So I've had all that all around the world. And the variety was very interesting.
I imagine the least enjoyable part of teaching would be the drudgery of hundreds of students, what it takes to keep track of them, grade their work.
No,
is there something to that?
Not really. The most unenjoyable is if you have to grade papers. However, in teaching 600 student class, you have about 10 TAs, and supervising them was quite a bit of work, but they graded a lot of papers. And after they graduated and got PhDs, they complained about it. They had to grade these papers. But on the whole, I didn't have too much of that. And if a student complained too much and start crying, I send them to the Wailing Wall.
The Wailing Wall.
There is a Wailing Wall.
The Wailing Wall?
Well, if they wanted to go there, but we set up a wall on the campus.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
Where was it?
I can't remember.
You know, it's not unusual for faculty members to help students become doctors themselves, but a career as long as yours, I wonder if you have an extraordinarily large number of people who have earned doctorates in economics.
Yeah, about 40.
With you.
Yeah,
that's a large number?
Well, it's more than the average, shall we say. Yeah.
Like a lot of your career, more than average.
Yeah, I guess so.
It's always fun when talking with someone like you who's been on campus this long to talk about the campus you arrived on in 1957 and compare it to the campus today. Of course, it's grown exponentially. But talk about the MSU you arrived at in 1957.
Well, it was under President Hanna, who was a builder, fundamentally a builder. I think I served under 7 or 8 presidents over the years, and Hanna built the place. It was small. I can't remember, maybe 20,000 students or even less at the time. Not all built. There were kind of makeshift housing all around. And the spirit was good. It just turned from a Michigan State College to a Michigan State University. And people were kind of excited. It was good spirit at the time. And it did develop. Now, this building wasn't there at the time, the one we are sitting in now. And look at it now.
Yeah.
Well, that's true in general. The economics department, well, we occupied the floor in Morrill Hall when I first came, I believe. That's the one that now obliterated. And then we moved to Marshall Hall. And then, quite a few years later, Marshall Hall, we received a grant of $7 million. Marshall Hall was gutted. They kept the frame and was rebuilt all the way from scratch in the inside. And it's now a magnificent building. And sometimes Michigan State used to send me to talk to former students who made good financially about, contributing. And I remember talking to one of them who managed or owned a hedge fund in New York. And he said, "I loved Marshall Hall." And I said, "Well, we're keeping the frame." That's probably what he loved. That was kind of interesting.
We're talking with Mordecai Max Krinen, who is retiring from the MSU Department of Economics after 57 years at MSU. I want to spend a few minutes talking with you about the condition of MSU in the 1980s, really tough economic times, and the credit given to you by some with helping MSU get through the tough economic times of the 1980s. You came up with a plan that encouraged a voluntary buyout to help trim the budget, that sort of thing. The story in the Lansing State Journal gave you really high marks on that score. I just wanted to ask you for your own reflection on those times and your role in it.
It was a tough time. I was a member of the Academic Council at the time. Actually, it started before Cecil Mackey was president. And I was at the time a chairman of a committee on the academic environment, which meant dealing with all the issues of the university besides the academic. And President Mackey decided that all those other vice presidents that are not the provost, the academic vice president, should cut their budget by 15%. When I assumed that role of being chairman of this committee, I was told it's a committee that never met. I said, "Well, you can put me up." And then I went on sabbatical to Sweden, I was brought back from Sweden to head that committee and dealing with all these vice presidents. Well, I had to approve or disapprove what they wanted to do, and if I disapproved, I had to come up with an alternative. And there were issues there. There were conflicts that had to be resolved, and I don't know that I want to go over those on the air. Then came the issue of faculty shrinkage. And the administration at the time wanted to fire either 100 or 200 tenured faculty and do away with a fair number of programs. Well, the students didn't like it. The faculty didn't like it. There was a big tumult on the campus. Nobody knew what to do. And so I remember going into my office, closing the door, putting paper in front of me, and starting to think, is there another way to resolve this conflict, which seemed to be unresolvable? And I came up with the idea that instead of firing anybody, which would simply lead to 200 court cases, we can do a buyout plan. That was before there was buyouts in any educational system. In other words, it was the first. It took me a while to push it through. It was not that simple. A lot of people opposed it. A lot of people thought it wouldn't work. I remember one academic council meeting where a friend of mine says, I don't think it'll work. And I said, you know, we are all on the supply curve. It'll work if you offer them enough money. We worked out a plan, made those offers. I wasn't eligible for a buyout because the economics was in dire straits for people. But there were departments that were, and the program worked.
Some of our listeners might remember back in the day that I did a call-in show here, and you were a guest on the show once a month or so, just to take questions from listeners about the economy. And I bring it up because of one or two incidents that stick in my mind where callers didn't really have a question. Instead, they called to attack you. And it was for one of two things or both, liberal economics in their terms and your Judaism. And it occurs to me to ask you about being a Jew in America for all these years and in Michigan. And if you have any reflections on what Jewish life has been like in East Lansing.
Well, let me answer it in a variety of levels. I heard a lot about anti-Semitism. I know what it's like. I know what Europe is like. It's terrible there. Ever since I came here, I never faced any animosity or anything about being a Jew. I didn't advertise it. I didn't hide it. Everybody knew who I was. I just don't remember a single incident that happened. Well, East Lansing is a small community. And raising Jewish children in a small community where they are the only Jew in the class is not easy. Because why should I go to Sunday school? All my friends don't go to Sunday school. Well, why can't I have a Christmas tree like all my friends? Then they came to have bat mitzvah. They were all girls. And they had glorious bat mitzvah. The party was at the U Club. And all their Christian friends went to their parents. And they said, why can't I have a bat mitzvah? So it was difficult to now they grew up and they're all Jewish, and they live in big cities where they don't have this problem of the only kid in class. So It was difficult from that respect to live in a small community. The community is now larger. And there are two congregations, not one. There's a joke about a Jew stranded on an island and being asked, if you had a lot of money, what would you do? He says, I'd build two synagogues. He says, what do you need two synagogues? He says, there's got to be one I don't belong to. So we do have two synagogues, and Jewish life is much stronger than it used to be. Hillel functions very well, which didn't used to. And there are probably 3,000 Jewish students on the campus, a Jewish study program. All these things didn't exist. Today, it's more vibrant. And we're thankful for that.
I have one final question for you, Mordecai Krinen, and that has to do with your post-retirement life. I'm reminded of Walter Adams keeping his office and being there virtually every day until he died. Are you planning to keep working in some fashion? Are you planning to keep an office, keep office hours? What sort of activity level are you planning?
No, I'm not going to keep office hours. But the department will probably give me a retiree's office. And I will be there. I actually have one in the business school, and I will be in both of them whenever I can. Most of what I do, I have about five hobbies that I do. Professionally, I still intend to work with young people who want help. And I've done that, and I'll just continue to do that. As long as I can. I mean, a lot depends on health. So, yes, I plan to continue to some degree.
Well, we call this series Voices of Experience, and it's a real pleasure and honor to include you, Mordecai Krinen. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.